Police officers are tasked with keeping order in our communities and ensuring residents and visitors engage in lawful conduct. It can be a difficult job where decisions sometimes need to be made in seconds, especially when people are at risk, in crisis, and threatening themselves or others. After APD officers shot and killed four people in Anchorage over the last few months, some Alaskans are calling for change. Law enforcement officials and defense attorneys join us to answer questions about use of force and how cases are investigated today on Talk of Alaska. From Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. What are the best methods to avoid fatalities when officers must stop dangerous behavior? Community trust is crucial for effective policing. How can trust be built up and maintained between Alaskans and local law enforcement, especially when many citizens perceive that officers will never be held accountable for excessive or lethal force until and unless there is a new system of scrutiny outside of the legal profession? What would that oversight look like? Who would conduct the independent review of officer actions, and what would the findings require? Here to help describe how tragedies can happen during an emergency call to police is Anchorage Police Chief Sean Case. Also in the studio today is Rich Kirtner. Rich is a retired defense attorney and also the chair of the Alaska Black Caucus Justice Committee. And John Skidmore is in the studio as well. John is an assistant attorney general and state prosecutor. Welcome, all of you. Thank you so much for being here for this very important discussion today. Chief Case, I want to start with you and have you start us off here. Describe what officers are thinking about during a crisis call when someone is a threat to themselves or others. What does their training require of them in those tense moments?
Well, training starts with when the call for service comes in, and they are trained to take every piece of information, and even you can back up a step forward and talk about our call takers and our dispatchers, because the police department becomes involved at the time that we get a call from the community. And the information that we train our call takers to take is as much information as possible so that the officers are prepared the best they can going into a situation. So even just thinking about what direction and route they're going to take so they can take the safest route in. So things that we don't think about, officers are taking into consideration when they're arriving on the scene, as well as how many officers are attached to the call, what tools that those officers bring in their toolbox. So if they're trained in crisis negotiation, if they have less lethal with them, those are all thought processes that are going in regardless of the contact with whoever we're responding to. So they have a tremendous amount of information that they're taking in prior to showing up on the call. And once they arrive on the call, now they've got a number of people that may be present, a number of external factors. They have 360 degrees of information that they're taking in at that time. And when the call gets more and more serious or violent, or there's more of an immediate threat, we're humans like everybody else. And so our focal point starts to narrow down into the immediate threat. And so that's sometimes when you watch officer-involved shooting videos, whether with APD or around the country, you'll see that officers will start to narrowly focus in on what has been identified as the threat. And those encounters, when officers make the decision whether or not to use lethal force, usually those are seconds or less that they're making those decisions. So even though they may be on scene for 7 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, if you start the clock as to when an officer observes that threat, which may be different from when a body worn camera picks up the threat, it's seconds or less, sometimes fractions of a second. And they have time to only take in so much information. And sometimes that's limited information based on what they're perceiving at that moment in time. And they're also dealing with, you know, the emotional reaction that they're having, you know, the fear that takes place when some sort of weapon is presented.
And does the training that they receive, what are you thinking about in those very, very tense seconds when the order has been given more than once to drop the weapon, that's not happening? What is the thought process then? Is it that officers are thinking they have to hold a certain line so that a person with a with a weapon doesn't escape into the night or create a threat outside of that immediate area, what's happening in between that demand to drop the weapon that's not happening and then shots are fired?
So we're obviously trying to take in the response to the commands that we're giving and how the person is reacting. But when you interview officers after a critical incident, like an officer-involved shooting, particularly when you bring in body-worn camera after we get a statement and you look at the reaction that the officer has between, this is what I was thinking at the time, this is what I saw, heard, observed at the time, and then they watch the video and they realize they don't recall information that they actually captured. And so that's where you hear kind of that term, you know, training took over, and I don't remember certain things happening. But then they watch the video and they go, but I know what happened because I just saw it on the video. Or if you ask an officer how many rounds they fired, they're almost never going to be accurate in how many rounds. Certain things that are said that you can hear on audio or video, they will pick some of it up and they won't pick up some of it. Or they'll have a very fine focal point that you ask yourself, how did the officer notice? Like we've done interviews with officers in certain scenarios where they can tell you whether or not someone had their finger on the trigger or not. And other officers just, they don't pick that up. That's a fine thought process. And it's where your mind takes you. It's your area of focus. I mean, if your area of focus is off by just a little bit and the immediate threats in a half a second or less, what I see and what the officer next to me sees could be two completely different things. So it really is training that takes over in that critical moment. And that's why, you know, not only academy training, but in-service training, particularly scenario-based training, is significantly important. The other thing that we find is experience makes a significant difference. Because once you see the scenarios unfold over time, once you get to about 7 years on the department, data will show that certain body movements, officers will connect. You know, a body movement that indicates somebody is reaching the front of their waistband, they will be ahead in their decision-making versus an officer that's brand new. They haven't seen it before. They haven't seen it in real time before. They haven't seen the consequences of those types of movements. So there's really a difference between a 1 year, a 7 year, and a 15 year officer in their experience and how they apply that experience and training.
Sure, that makes sense. Chief, Anchorage police have shot 7 people since May, killing 4 of them. How have those incidents changed how the police department goes about its daily work?
Well, it certainly has an impact on the individual officers that go out and provide calls for service for the community, and whether they're an involved officer, whether they're a witness, or they use lethal force themselves, it also impacts the rest of the workforce. And the things that we're always concerned about is we don't want to create an environment within the police department where officers start hesitating. We want them to be responsive to the public. We want them to engage and try to keep the community safe, even in the face of danger. It's impressive when you look at the work that our officers do, and they don't hesitate no matter who the caller is. They don't even take that into consideration. They take the facts. And so that's something that we try to preserve as much as we can, is making sure that our officers are prepared to go into these situations without hesitation. So that's the first immediate impact. But above and beyond, and prior to the latest officer-involved shootings, we started looking at the way in which we respond to critical incidents, the training that we provide in the academy, the in-service training, July 1, and really started detailing out some of that training and looking at how training has impacted performance, which we haven't been doing a very good job of historically with the police department, and what type of training we want to add to the curriculum and what the desired effect is. And so you'll hear me in the months and years to come continuously talk about the additions that we made with training and whether or not that had a positive or a negative impact on the performance in the field.
And is that training that you're either doing now or considering for the future, is that in crisis de-escalation, or what is this training?
So we are at what I consider standard or above what common practices and training hours in pretty much every course and curriculum. You know, we have just under 1,000 hours of a training in our academy, which is far more than the state requires. And in a lot of the topics, we go above and beyond what you see around the country. And so for me, it's not about meeting or exceeding what the current standard is or what current best practice is. You know, my bar for the police department is not to meet what best practice is. It's to go far and above and beyond that. So when we talk about de-escalation, we have de-escalation training. You know, I started doing this job over 25 years ago, and we did de-escalation training 25 years ago. We called it verbal judo then, but it's had different names throughout the course of time. De-escalation is just the latest term that we use to describe that, but that has existed in law enforcement. And so adding 5 or 10 or 15 more hours of a subject like de-escalation doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get a different response, because that's existed. And so what we're looking at is, how do we create a learning environment and provide information to the officers and really take care of the officers more holistically so that they can better apply some of that training and information?
One more question, Chief Case, and then I'll move on to our other guests. Thanks for your patience here. Walk us through the steps when allegations of excessive force are leveled against an APD officer. What is the process? And if I'm understanding it correctly, the process starts right at the scene of the shooting. Is that correct?
So I'm going to separate, because I think we're talking two different concepts. If we're just talking specifically officer-involved shooting, or if somebody calls in and says, hey, I think an officer used excessive force on me, which scenario are we? You want me
officer
to?
Officer-involved shooting.
Okay. Yeah. So an officer-involved shooting, immediately when that incident takes place, we initiate two investigations at the same time. Now, it's very heavy on the criminal side, because that's the investigation that takes precedence. Obviously, there could be criminal charges. Not only criminal charges brought against the officer, but criminal charges brought against the individual that an officer either shot or shot at, particularly if they survive. And so we start a criminal homicide investigation just like we would for any other homicide investigation. So detectives are woken up in the middle of the night. If it happens in the middle of the night, crime scene team comes out. Our internal affairs investigators come out as well. And we start the collection of evidence at the scene at the time. We start physical evidence. We start collecting video that is maybe on buildings or ring cameras. Collecting witnesses, witness statements, those witnesses that exist, whether they're officers or members of the public, we bring them down to the police station. And again, whether you're an officer or a member of the public, we separate everybody so that they aren't communicating with each other. And the detectives start looking at the evidence and start doing interviews that night. And so they work through the civilian as well as the officer interviews that are witnesses. And then they continue to collect evidence. It's also important to know that the Office of Special Prosecution also gets called out to oversee this investigation and make sure that we're collecting all the things that we need to collect so that they can do an adequate review, which I'm sure you'll hear about in a little bit in more detail. And then the officer that is involved in the shooting that used lethal force, they'll provide a statement generally between 24 and 72 hours later. Now, because they are treated as a criminal suspect like anybody else, they have the opportunity to not provide a statement in a criminal investigation. By and large, our officers overwhelmingly will provide that criminal statement. So they will sit down with homicide detectives, and they will be interviewed and interrogated like similar to a homicide suspect. And that's a trying time for them, because the consequence of their action is criminal prosecution. And then when that portion is done, the homicide detective will continue to conduct that investigation, and eventually they'll turn it over to the Office of Special Prosecution. Once the Office of Special Prosecution concludes their investigation, whatever that may be, then our administrative investigation starts in terms of the physical work. And they've been present, so they know what's happening. They've been monitoring the criminal investigation, but they'll actually start doing their investigation, their interviews as well. If we have an officer that declines a criminal interview after using lethal force, they can't decline an interview as part of a condition of their employment. So at a minimum, we'll get a statement out of them at that time. And the administrative investigation has some similarities with the criminal, but it's much, much broader. They're looking at training tactics. They're looking at policy violations. So it's a very wide scope. So even though the officers have been interviewed already and even witnesses have been interviewed, the internal affairs will come in and they may redo interviews with all of those people because they want to, they got a wider scope what they're looking at. And so now you have a criminal and administrative investigation, both which could have consequences.
Well, thank you so much for that good description of what's happening there. If you're just joining us, I want to remind our listeners that this is Talk of Alaska, and today we are talking with Anchorage Police Chief Sean Case. Also in the studio with us today is Rich Kirtner, who is a retired public defender and chair of the Alaska Black Caucus Justice Committee. And John Skidmore is in the studio as well. John is an assistant attorney general and a state prosecutor. We're talking about use of force by police and what the way forward may look like for ensuring that there is trust between the community and police. So we have heard about how the APD cases are investigated, but John, as Chief Case just relayed, APD has the homicide division look at officer-involved shootings. Troopers have a unit for investigating, but coordinate with the Office of Special Prosecutions. Why is the investigation going on internally rather than everything being referred to the outside Office of Special Prosecutions?
The Office of Special Prosecutions, like most of the Department of Law Criminal Division, don't have investigators. We don't have the capacity to go out and conduct the interviews that you heard Chief Case talk about. We don't have the capacity to go out and collect evidence, to pick up the shell casings at the scene, to do a scene diagram, to map everything out. We've never been staffed that way. I don't think you find most offices in the lower 48 handle it that way either. There is always an investigatory agency that comes in to conduct the interviews, collect the physical evidence, and turn all of that information over to the prosecutors. That would also include the collection of other records. So if somebody is killed in the shooting, then we're looking for an autopsy report. If the person is injured in the shooting, then we're looking for medical records. So there's a lot of information that has to be pulled together, but that's the role of the investigatory agencies. Once that information is compiled, then the role of the prosecutors, the role of special prosecutions, is to evaluate all of that information the same way we do for any other report of a crime that's provided to us by law enforcement all across the state. We're going to look at all of that information. Then we're going to take those facts and we're going to apply the law to those facts to determine whether or not a crime occurred.
Once the investigation is finished, if a determination is that no crime occurred, mm-hmm. you issue a declination letter?
Correct.
Describe the lead up to this letter and how the public can review them.
Well, declination letters are a formal determination that charges are not going to be filed. In the typical referral from a law enforcement agency where we decide not to pursue charges, we don't write declination letters. It's just a determination by the prosecutor who makes a note in their file why they're declining a particular case, and that goes away. Most of the public doesn't ever know anything about it. When it comes to an officer-involved shooting, because that is such a public occurrence, because that is something that the public has so much interest in, and because law enforcement needs to know. You heard Chief Case talk about their administrative investigation. They need to know when they can start that administrative investigation. And so we review all of those officer-involved shootings, and we write what I would describe as a fairly detailed and thorough letter about our review of the facts and how the law was applied to it and what conclusions we reached. Those letters are then provided to the police agency. Historically, I'm talking more than 10 years ago, those letters weren't a matter of public record. They were just provided to the police agency. Mm-hmm. But about 10 years ago, then Attorney General Mike Garrity decided he didn't want that information to only be from the prosecutor to law enforcement. He actually wanted to make those letters public. And so we changed policy at that time, and we started to release those letters. Those letters are sent out and made available to folks. We generally do a press release where we send it out to media so that they're aware of the fact that they occurred. They have a copy of it. Those letters remain a public record for 1 year after we've made the determination. At the conclusion of that year, by statute, then they're no longer considered public information anymore. But there's a copy that's already been released. Somebody's probably got a copy out there. You just can't get that from our department any longer under the way the statutes are created.
All right. Rich, I want to turn to you now. Thank you for your patience. You said in an earlier interview that you learned about the Office of Special Prosecutions while pushing for body cameras for officers. In your 45 years as a public defender, has this the Office of Special Prosecutions ever found an officer guilty of excessive use of force?
No. From my look at this, never. I mean, in the whole history of Anchorage Police Department in shooting statewide, I think there may have been 150 investigations that have gone through the Office of Special Prosecutions or other type of investigations, and there has never been a shooting, police-involved shooting, that was found to be not justified. And this has created, I think, a real problem of trust in the community. And I think body cameras are going to, they're going to be a game changer for that. Because when I joined the Alaska Black Caucus after I retired, we advocated for body cameras. And in April 2021, that's when the voters decide, yeah, we want body cameras, we want them now, and we'll help pay for them. And then 3 years, we worked to get them on the street. And it was the prior administration, the prior chief of police, that was taught me that there was no transparency in this process. And so that's why we've been discussing with other community organizations some kind of civilian oversight so that the community is more involved in that.
And I want to get to ideas about that in just a bit, but the fact that and John, I think you've confirmed that there have been no findings of excessive use of force for any.
Again, I want to clarify, just like Chief Case did, when we say excessive use of force, that means something different to us than simply an officer-involved shooting. In officer-involved shootings, Mr. Kirtner's correct, there have not been charges filed. But when you talk about excessive use of force, that's when officers exceed the amount of force that they're allowed to use in contacts with civilians. We absolutely have filed those charges. We've convicted police of those charges. And we have other charges like that that are pending right now in the state of Alaska. So we do file charges against law enforcement when they exceed their authority in the type of force that they can use. However, for shootings, it's accurate. We have not encountered a scenario in which a law enforcement officer has exceeded their authority under law for when they can and cannot use deadly force. I would submit to the public that's because our officers go through substantial training on the use of force, and they understand what they have to do, where those lines are. And then we also have to keep in mind that, I mean, Mr. Kirtner talks about this idea that there's a lack of trust because there have been so many shootings and no officer's ever been charged. But I think that completely ignores what it is we ask law enforcement to do in our community. They're the ones that citizens call when they think somebody has committed a crime. They're the ones that citizens call when they think that there is a person out in the public who is a danger to everybody else. And we ask law enforcement to come and deal with that situation. The idea that there aren't going to be confrontations as the result of that, I think, is unrealistic.
So, but you do acknowledge that there is an issue of trust, that the public has expressed that they are concerned. We heard a mother at the community meeting last week say she's afraid of what might happen because her children have special needs. They like to play with fake weapons, and she's very worried about what might occur if she had to call police. And so that seems like there's a breakdown there in what is a very important factor, as you just acknowledged. If citizens see something, we need for them to call the police, correct?
Absolutely. And I'm not saying that there isn't an issue with trust, but trust is in part based on how we all go about talking about these issues and having a realistic understanding of what we ask law enforcement to do, what they're authorized to do, and when that is exceeding the scope of what they've been asked to do. Have there been a number of shootings? Absolutely. Have any of those shootings to date been a situation in which an officer has committed a crime in the use of that force when it comes to shootings? The answer is no, they have not. And to suggest that somehow, just because there have been a lot of them, that one of them should have been charged would suggest that we're not actually reviewing cases on a case-by-case basis to ensure that officers are following the law. And that's exactly what we want to do, the same way we do for any other citizen who's accused of committing a crime.
All right, let's go to the phones for just a moment before we take a break. Martin is in Fairbanks. Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
2 months ago, I heard a public radio broadcast regarding a company called Lexipol, who apparently has widespread contracts with police departments around the country. They advise police departments what to do in cases like officer-involved shootings. There's a very interesting broadcast by Reveal, which is a contributor to public radio often. Does the Anchorage Police Department have a contract with Lexipol or other similar agency?
All right, Martin, thank you for the question. Chief Case.
We don't have a contract with Lexipol. I'm very familiar with Lexipol. We've done training with Lexipol and the organization. Lexipol's got a lot of things that they do. They do a lot of training. They also do policy development. We had a contract about 10 years ago and have updated our use of force policies with an outside entity similar to Lexipol. So we didn't draft those policies ourselves and come up with the content. Those were updated in October of last year. Again, we look at them and update them about every 2 years if there's new information that we need to put into those policies. And kind of as a just additional informative, the Alaska Association of Chiefs of Police just had a state grant that is looking at a statewide policy manual. So all law enforcement agencies within the state would have a statewide policy manual that they could adopt at their agency if they chose to. And that was an open RFP process that's still ongoing. And so here in the next couple of months, we should know what agencies put in for that RFP and which one was selected. And then moving forward, Alaska will be developing a policy manual for the entire state. It's not going to be required that every police agency adopt that particular manual, but we will certainly have the opportunity individually as agencies on whether or not we want to adopt that manual.
All right. We are going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the use of force by police and how to ensure that the public is safe, that order is maintained, and that there is accountability and trust among law enforcement and the community as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing police authority in communities and citizen concern about excessive use of force and what the best way forward is for all. You can join our conversation with Anchorage Police Chief Sean Case, who is in the studio with us today. Also, we have on hand Rich Kirtner, who is a retired public defender and chair of the Alaska Black Caucus Justice Committee. And also in the studio is John Skidmore. John is a deputy attorney general and state prosecutor. So, John, just quickly, I wanted to ask you, you had said that there was a review of the Office of Special Prosecution's decisions over the years. Who did the review and what were the findings?
The University of Alaska at Anchorage had worked with the Office of Special Prosecutions. They wanted to do a study about all the officer-involved shooting cases that had been reviewed by Special Prosecutions. And so we had signed a contract with them that allowed them to have access to all that information. They looked at all of those different cases and then published a report. I apologize, I don't have the report with me this morning, but the report essentially described the patterns that they found and talked overall about the shootings, and they suggested additional research that they thought might be of importance or significance to the community at large.
Rich, your thoughts about that study?
Yeah, I read the study, and it went through to 2015, So it points out some of the investigation, but it just again proves that that study looked at 45 shootings, and it found none of them that it weren't justified in the author of that was used to work with special prosecutions at some time and make these decisions. So I read the report, but I think the point here is right now there is a community concern about police involved shootings with 4 people killed in the last couple of months, And now that the video, a body camera, is public, I've looked at the video cam, the recordings from body cams on 2 of those shootings. Now, I respectfully can disagree with Mr. Skidmore that they're justified for a lot of reasons, but I don't think our community wants somebody in the Attorney General's office making that decision in their office. I think that they would have to have more community involvement in that decision. And I'm suggesting that we refer these cases to a grand jury of citizens here in Anchorage to make that decision. John applies, they get the facts, they get the law, but the big judgment is applying the law to the facts. And we might disagree on how we do that and what our conclusions are. But I think if you had a grand jury of citizens look at these cases and then deciding with the subpoena power they have, with the time they can devote, in a group decision on these shootings, whether they're justified or not, I think it's a better process that we should look at. Now, there are other cities that automatically refer every police-involved shooting to a grand jury. Hmm. And there are police officers because of that are on trial in certain cases. And the grand jury only decides, is there probable cause after looking at everything? Is probable cause that a crime was committed? Now, John's going to look at, is there a defense to it? And then we'd have to prove the defense. We have to disprove the defense of self-defense. And so, he's doing an assumption of the whole trial, whereas a grand jury is a different process. They look to see if there's any probable cause that a crime was committed, and then it goes through the criminal justice system. So I think that would greatly increase the community's confidence in these decisions.
Let me ask one follow-up first. Where would the grand jury get the information that they would be reviewing? Would they get that from the police investigators themselves?
No, they could get it from special prosecutions. Special prosecutions could call a grand jury, could present everything they have to the grand jury. It's just that there's a different decision maker.
Okay.
That's the key.
Mr. Skidmore, you want to follow up there?
Yeah, I want to make sure that I correct something there. I respectfully disagree with Mr. Kirtner. When we go to grand jury, it's not simply probable cause that the crime occurred. We also have an obligation as prosecutors to present what's called exculpatory evidence. If I went to a grand jury and there was a clear self-defense case and we didn't present that self-defense, we'd have to do that grand jury all over again. So they will be looking at everything that we as prosecutors would be looking at. Right now in the state of Alaska, what the Alaska Constitution says is that any individual who's going to be charged with a felony, that charging decision can initially be made by a prosecutor, but then a grand jury has to agree to that in order for the case to move forward. And what Mr. Kirtner is proposing is that you skip that first step where the prosecution looks at it and says, is this worth a grand jury's time to review or not, and just automatically send cases to the grand jury. But in terms of what they look at and in terms of the determination they're making, they're going to be making the exact same sort of determination that we as prosecutors make, which is there probable cause for this crime, but as well, is there a defense that says that this charge should not be filed? So it's the exact same review that we would be doing.
Yeah. Chief Case, your thoughts about this idea of a citizen grand jury, which, of course, would be citizens. It would not be people that are necessarily trained in police protocols or how to examine these things. What would you think about something like that? Do you think it would be well for helping to build trust in the community, or do you see problems?
Well, the way we handle these cases now outside of law enforcement, every single case does not go to grand jury. We allow our prosecuting team to evaluate the evidence and determine whether or not they want to go to grand jury. So we'd be creating a separate process where if you're an officer involved in an officer-involved shooting, regardless of the circumstances, regardless of the facts, the information, automatically it's going to be going to grand jury. So now as an officer, you're signing up to do a job that we're going to train you. We are going to put tools and skills and weapons in your ability. We're going to expect you to use them on certain calls for service, depending upon the circumstances that you're going into. And then you're going to sign up for that job knowing that if you do shoot somebody in the course of your duties, as you've been trained to do, you'll be investigated for committing a criminal offense. And then you're also going to be going to grand jury. And that's concern. This is a stressful, strenuous process for these officers to go through. We train them to make these decisions. When we look at the number of police contacts that we have, and the number of times we use force. So for instance, we use force, not just deadly force, any type of force. And let me define force to you. It's anything above compliant handcuffing. So if you comply when I handcuff, we don't record that as a use of force. We record that as handcuffing. Anything above that, anything that the officer needs to do, even apply a little bit of force to get a hand behind your back to place a handcuff, we collect that as a use of force. That is documented. And any use of force that is a punch, a strike, intermediate weapon, so that we look at a taser or OC pepper spray, any of those are fully investigated, whether there's a complaint or not. So their actions are scrutinized. And when you look at the number of contacts that police have, well under a single percent of all the contacts we have results in any use of force of any sort. So I think we need to put it in perspective with the public what that use of force looks like and how often we actually use force, and that it is a very, very unusual event.
All right, we're going back to the phones for a moment here. Dale is in Fairbanks. Hello, Dale.
Hello.
Did you have a question?
Yes. I wonder why officers always shoot to kill, 3 or 4 shots into the torso. Why isn't there, why don't they try to maim? For example, we had a woman threatening the officers with a knife. Was it necessary to kill her?
All right, Dale, thanks for the question. That Dale's question follows up on an email that we also received about the 16-year-old that was shot in Anchorage. Barbara writes, I'm so angry that our local law enforcement officers recently shot and killed a 16-year-old girl at her home. I understand she threatened one of her sisters with a knife. She responded to the police also by approaching them with a knife. I can't believe they wouldn't allow another sister to talk the girl down. Also cannot believe that lethal force was needed. Couldn't multiple adults overcome a kid by means other than shooting her to death? Are the police not trained in martial arts or to use a taser? If guns are necessary to stop a threat, why can't shots be aimed to body parts that won't kill the subject? The same question that Dale is presenting here. Chief Case, talk about what the training is and why you're shooting for that main mass of the body.
So officers are trained to, when they get to the point where they're defending, and that's I think the important point that we back up to, is that they're using lethal force because they believe that there's an immediate defense of life, either themselves or somebody else. And as I mentioned earlier, that decision generally takes place in under a second. And so they have to react very quickly, and what they're trained to do is to stop that threat. And when they're trained to stop that threat, they also have to be considerate of things like the background, homes or people that are in the background. And so in that fraction of a second time, they are trained to fire at whatever the largest top target is on that person. So that doesn't necessarily mean the center of the torso if that's not the largest target that they have. It also doesn't move around. You know, arms and legs are moving. And for those folks, and we've had a lot of them in the state of Alaska that have fired a handgun, when you have a target that's just right in front of you at 5 or 6 feet and no stress, you can hit that target relatively easily. But you had stress, you had movement, you had a lot of chaos, and trying to find a very small moving target in a very compressed time makes it very, very challenging.
Mm-hmm. All right, Chief, at the community meeting that we discussed that was last week, you noted a rise in gun violence in Anchorage just sort of generally. Talk about that. What are you seeing?
So year to date, we're seeing about a 15 to 20% increase in weapons offenses. So that's a couple different categories of crimes that are included in that. And so we're seeing that increase. Now, I will say in the last 28 days, we'll repeat that again. The last 28 days, we've seen a 7.4% decrease in those types of incidents. So that doesn't mean that we're going to call this a trend and that 15 to 20% increase is now definitely on the decline, because we just have one 28-day snapshot. But it is something that we're obviously paying attention to, monitoring, and hopefully in the next couple of months, we can say it's a downward trend. But we have seen an increase of weapons offenses in Anchorage.
All right, we are going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about policing and community safety. Policing and community safety as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. For all of you, and Rich, I want you to respond here first. Some Anchorage citizens want to model a citizen oversight board on the work of an organization called the National Association for Civilian Oversight of Law Enforcement. It's been around since 1995. Are you familiar with this org, and do you think there is guidance here to adopt? Rich, what do you know about it?
Yes, that's Nicole. They have advised civilian review boards all around the country, including some of the civilian review boards that I've talked to people on. So they're kind of a resource for anybody starting a civilian review board. I think that's a resource for us. If we start developing that, so and that's a start. And I think that you know, there's different types of civilian review boards. I've been working with a coalition of community organizations, the Alaska Coalition for Justice, with the Native Movement, the NAACP, the ACLU, the Pacific Island Community, and in Ackberg, and we in the Black Caucus. So we've all been working on trying to work with the administration and the assembly on creating some type of a civilian oversight that would work in our city.
Chief Case, your thoughts. I think that you said in July, I'm pretty sure in July, you said you don't think it's time for another layer of oversight. What are your thoughts about maybe not this national organization, but Rich just talking about the groups of citizens that are right here in Anchorage coming together and looking for something? Do you see that there could be a pathway to some sort of citizen group being involved?
I think we have citizen oversight with the mayor and the assembly. We're accountable to them, and the voters, we're accountable to the voters through our elected bodies. You know, right now, one of the things that the mayor has called for is an independent investigation of an officer-involved shooting and of the Easterly office shooting. And that's no longer an internal investigation. That's an external investigation. That is significant. This is not what you typically would see, which is the internal body conducts the investigation, and then they hand that investigation over to some level of oversight, and they look at it and they review it, and depending upon the model of civilian oversight, they either get to help determine findings, or they get to form some sort of opinion, or sometimes they have subpoena powers. This is that investigation is being conducted by somebody outside. So when we think about civilian oversight, we need to understand that what has been called for this particular incident is significant. It is not only significant to Anchorage and Anchorage Police Department, but it's significant around the country. And that is that. There's no civilian oversight that created that. That is our elected people. And that means that a very broad base throughout Anchorage, they are the ones that elect our assembly members and our mayors. And those individuals that are in those positions have the opportunity to provide additional layers of oversight and are currently doing so that they can determine whether or not what the Anchorage Police Department is doing is what they feel is appropriate. And some, when I say appropriate, some of that is outside of the law and some of that is outside of our policies. In other words, we're trying to come together as a community to solve this and come to a better resolution that may have maybe, again, outside our administrative investigation and our criminal investigation. So I think that's pretty significant.
Mm-hmm. John, you mentioned during the break that in law, once officers have made the determination that they need to use force, there's describe what you were talking about. There's not a difference between maiming force and lethal force, correct?
Sure. So there are two Alaska statutes really that apply there. The first one talks about when non-deadly use of force is authorized. And that's just if you reasonably believes that you need to engage in force to protect yourself. But when deadly force becomes authorized, that's if there's a risk of death, risk of serious physical injury, kidnapping, sexual assault, sexual abuse, or robbery. So in those circumstances, once you're authorized to use deadly force, then it's not, well, you need to shoot somebody in the knee or you need to try and shoot the gun out of their hand or something that you see in the movies. It's, no, no, deadly force is authorized. And then you start to run into, in addition to what the law says, you also start to run into the issues that Chief Case talks about in terms of how is that supposed to, how are officers supposed to go about their jobs? And if you also think about the concept of trying to shoot someone in a appendage other than center body mass, you're also now worried about if you miss that person, where is that bullet going? What's behind what you're shooting towards? And now you have risks to all sorts of other folks. So it's, I just want folks to understand and appreciate how complex it is to look at those issues and to understand that the law says, once you're authorized to use deadly force, you're authorized to use deadly force, end of story.
All right. Rich, you wanted to weigh in there?
Yes, please. So I would invite everybody to, if you get a chance, to watch the videos of Christopher Handy and Tyler May. I think they're now public. And I would even go back to 2019. Bashar Hassan was videotaped on a dash cam. But if you look at those, you'll see that we're not talking about pistols. We're talking about military-style rifles, and we're talking about 15 or 20 rounds fired at somebody from two or three officers in just about a few seconds. And, you know, when I first saw the video of Bashar Hassan and three police officers and three cruisers killing this guy from English was a second language, and my first thought was, this is an execution by firing squad. You hear about that from the wars, and you see it from different countries, and I was shocked to see that in Anchorage. If anybody looks at that video, I dare them not to have the same conclusion. This was a public information by firing squad when you got assault rifles and semi-automatic rifles that fire 15, 20 rounds in just a few seconds.
Rich, to say that it's like a firing squad is to say that the person was standing there with their hands tied behind their back and somebody gives the order, now shoot to kill this person. And I think that's a disservice to suggest that law enforcement officers are engaging in that type of use of force. I agree with you. I encourage people to look at the videos.
Okay.
I do think the public needs to look at those things, but I think we need to be careful with our language because we earlier talked about trust. And when you say things like a firing squad, you're now suggesting to the community at large, all those people listening to our voices, that somehow law enforcement are lining people up, handcuffing them, and then very calmly saying, now it's time to execute this person. And that's not what happens.
Chief Case, I want you to get in here. You know, we've been talking about information getting out to the public in a timely fashion so that they can better understand what happened. There's been debate about when to release the body cam camera footage of officers. And as we know, there are so many other people recording things now that are sometimes live streamed to social media or they're posted immediately after an event. So the public is getting these looks from other sources quite early on. Does that change your thinking about when to release the official video of these things, or what goes into that consideration so that people understand why it may take time?
Yeah, this is going to be an ongoing debate that we're going to continue to shape as we move forward with more of these critical incidents that involve body cams. But what I can tell you is I'll talk about a perfect world, and then I'll talk about reality for a second. In a perfect world, we release those videos almost immediately. Because if there's one thing I care about, it is what the community, what happens with our community between the time they are notified there's been an officer-involved shooting and the time factual information gets out. And that allows our community to worry, to, you know, trust can get diminished. As human beings, we're all this way. We're going to fill in the gaps where we don't have information. And depending upon your relationship with the police department or your background, or there's all sorts of reasons how we're going to fill that in and how we're going to create that story. And that creates anxiety, creates tension.
And there's the court of social media.
There is the court of public opinion is strong. And all of those things concern me in terms of our relationship with the public. Now, that's the perfect world scenario. I also happen to love, like most of the people in this state, that we have the constitutional right to privacy. And if you love it, you got to love the knife that cuts both ways. And that means that there's protections in place. And we can't release a video 2 or 3 or 4 days after an officer-involved shooting, because the people, whether it's the officer or somebody that we fired our weapon at, that is potentially or is under investigation for potential crime, they have a right under the Constitution as well to have an investigation and a trial that's not tried in the public opinion as well. And although that's frustrating to some, it's frustrating to me as well as being the chief of police department, because I know that there's a lot of time to shape that emotion before the facts come out. And I'm sensitive to that. But again, I'm also a big believer in that right to privacy that we have. And I believe that we have an obligation, not only as a police department, but as the Office of Special Prosecution, the Attorney General's office, to protect that constitutional right as well.
And we had an email question, and Chief, I know that it's difficult for citizens to understand what officers face when they're answering a crisis call and you don't know what's all the particulars of what's happening. But Albert writes, how about asking the chief how screaming and shouting out commands at the top of one's lungs is a calming, de-escalating, non-confusing tactic for both officers and citizens? So when people are just reacting, you know, sort of looking at things after and saying, well, if I would have been there, I would have done this, or they should do that. Everybody's got an idea about what it's like or what should be happening. What's the reality when people are there and it's in that heated moment?
Yeah, I think the Tyler May video that's been made public is a perfect example. Officers are responding to a call with two individuals, both with a gun, both reported firing those weapons off when they responded. And when they responded, they were extremely calm. They were organized. They communicated with each other as they approached so that they could have a good tactical response. When they saw those individuals appear, they were very calm, very clear in what they said. It wasn't until those commands weren't followed they started yelling. So we got to back up to think about how calm and collected they were going into a call where they knew there were guns involved. They knew there was a high risk. They knew there was a potential they could have got shot at, and yet they remained calm, and they responded completely appropriately. And when those commands did not work, and somebody whom we believe had a gun took off running, they started yelling because they were being ignored. And so there's kind of two different pieces to that response.
All right. Well, this hour went by quite fast. Thank you so much for being here and talking to the public today. Our guests today were Anchorage Police Chief Sean Case, also Rich Kirtner, who is a retired public defender and chair of the Alaska Black Caucus Justice Committee, and John Skidmore, Deputy Attorney General and State Prosecutor, were all in the studio today. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, and on the phones, Ava White and Wesley Early helped us out. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. I'm Lori Townsend.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.